is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Good week for investors. Just about everything was going up, and especially gold. Are we going to have a lot to say about gold this week? Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me in Hour 1 will be Louise Yamada. Even though stocks are going up right now, she thinks this is a bear market rally here. You want to hear what Louise has to say about the markets and also her viewpoint on what's going on with interest rates. Even though bonds have rallied, watch what's going on in the short run. We'll also be talking to Dave Morgan. He's looking for confirmation on this gold bull market. He'd like to see the white metals move, mainly silver, platinum, and palladium. Dave will be joining me in Hour 1. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, we had a bull market in the metals in the first decade of the new century, and then everything went into sort of a malaise. But now we're seeing a new gold rise. And the question is this just a bear market rally or a genuine new bull market in the metals, given everything else that is going on? So we're going to examine the worldwide situation and see what kind of a conclusion we come to on that. Speaking of conclusions, storm warning. It seems like the leading economic indicators everywhere are indicating that there are serious storms ahead and approaching us, involving, of course, the central bank, our central bank, and other central banks. So what should you be doing in the light of the approaching storm? Well, first of all, you have to understand what's structuring it before you deal with your investments. But we'll do all of that today, have no fear, on the big picture as part of the Financial Sense News Hour. But Ryan Poplava, I think if there is a headline that would explain this week, it was an ECB beautiful week in the markets. That is to say, the European Central. Who writes this stuff anyway, right?
I thought it was clever.
That is to say, the European Central Bank, we do work off a loose script here, everybody, just so you know that, and we try to put things together for the show. That is to say that the European Central Bank, the ECB, which is where we got the ECB beautiful from, launched a bazooka shot right across the bow of this market with a number of policy changes which happened on Thursday that were viewed as nothing but dovish. And as you and our listeners know, things have been volatile, and it's been hard to juggle the fundamentals and the volatility of the markets as of late. Throw in a dose of monetary policy into the mix, and you get a situation maybe right now that the pressure is on to be in the market. So what do you have to say about this week's move, and what is the right catalyst that investors should be focusing upon?
Well, yeah, an EC, beautiful week, very clever. John, the three pieces that have influenced the markets, you know, we have today have been the same issues I've been focusing on for the last couple of years now. Monetary policy divergence. It's not a new thing. It's been happening ever since the Fed started to retract from its QE purchase program. There's also been this glut in oil supply. That has not been a new issue. It's something we've been experiencing for a couple of years. But the dumping from OPEC, essentially keeping their production levels high, as the U.S. is increasing their production, they did it to get back some market share and hurt the U.S. because they knew that they have a lower cost basis essentially for their oil. They can produce it a lot more cheaply than in shale. And then there's the lack of fiscal stimulus. You know, that continues to be an issue. We talked about the G20 from last week. Really nothing came from it. A promise to do more, but, you know, we really have not seen anything from that. So most of the factors moving the market this week are related to those factors in some shape or form, John. And we were opening up lower on Monday morning due to a drop in Chinese growth estimates at around 6.5% growth this year from 7% last year. So lowering the bar a little bit there, but the rally in oil and oil stocks continues to just support this market. We've talked about the high correlation between oil and the market, both on the downside and obviously right now on the upside. So that had an effect and helped to kind of stabilize things a little bit. And that's a stark change from January. The catalyst for a correction is usually the same catalyst that gets you out of one. So, you know, recall March 2009 when Citigroup, John, posted operational profits, and we essentially had moved mark-to-market accounting. And, you know, these were some of the issues that brought about the financial collapse and the breakdown in housing, et cetera. So if oil can continue to stabilize, that should help stocks. But the number one thing, you know, I've been hearing that will cause producers to ramp up production again is oil around $40. And if that happens, then again, there's that bearish catalyst to keep prices back down if we have more supply. And if you look at the inventory numbers, John, they've been going up. They just haven't been going up for some of the finished products out there, like fuel, heating oil, etc., which have been drawn down recently. And that's what bulls are focusing on when they look at those inventory data for the past couple of weeks. I think there was somebody else, I forget who, there was an energy association that essentially had looked at demand, and essentially the numbers that they had produced had caused a bullish move in some of the oil markets this week as well. And then, you know, OPEC's freeze on January production, that scared the shorts just a few weeks ago, and that continues to play itself out. So those are the major catalysts. They continue to kind of reverberate, and we did get updates on those in some shape or form this week.
Okay, now you touched on oil, but what about monetary divergence? I mean, does the move by the European Central Bank change the picture, or as Draghi always says, are they willing to do more? What were the specific moves? And expand on that a bit, you know, especially the market's reaction on Thursday and on Friday.
Yeah, it was a very interesting reaction both Thursday and Friday because they were kind of opposite. In fact, Thursday, the initial reaction was not the same as the reaction at the end of the day. So there was a cut in rates across the board. The deposit facility rate was cut from a negative 0.3% to negative 0.4%. And the main refinancing rate was cut down to zero. They expanded their monthly purchases. That was a very key thing because remember in December, we did not see that. What they just did is extended their purchase plan. They extended the duration of it. But this time they weren't going to leave any stone unturned. So they essentially had said the monthly purchases were going to move up from 60 billion euros up to 80. And that's going to go out to at least, they said, 2017 or possibly beyond. They added investment grade euro bonds as an asset they can essentially purchase. And on top of that, they also added four more, I believe, long-term refinancing operations maturing in 4 years with borrowing conditions, they said, as low as the main refinancing rate, which is essentially 0%. So it can go as low as 0%. And that's going to start in June of this year. So like I said, they didn't leave any stone unturned, John. They essentially did not want to underwhelm the market like they did in December. So looking at the initial move, the reaction is always more important necessarily than the news. And that initial move was a rise in the dollar, a drop in the euro, and European stocks were up initially as well. So that's the divergency trade, right? But even after all of the run-up that we had seen ahead of this meeting, stocks initially responded like they did because, like I said, they didn't want to underwhelm. They did give all that, I guess, in a bag of chips. The ECB didn't want to underwhelm. So that's essentially what they did not do. So here they hit every tool in their box. And John, they hit it with a sledgehammer. And if the market said they wanted it, they definitely got it. But okay, here's the thing. Here's how things kind of moved in the opposite direction later on Thursday. Like I said, the initial moves, dollar up, euro down, European stocks up, but that didn't last. What happened was in the press conference, Draghi basically said that he didn't anticipate that rates will need to be lowered any further. That reverberated. And so that was essentially a change in language from, as I've always said, they're willing to do more. So that little change right there, as going back to like 2010, David Tepper, in a very important interview that really influenced me a lot on CNBC, he essentially said that sometimes the central banks, they really make it that easy. So by that little remark by Draghi, it essentially had put a spin on the policy divergence trade that had been going on for the past year and a half. So that's what we saw. The dollar corrected. It started falling on Thursday. European stocks started to fall and gave up their gains. And then we saw a rally in the euro. So it was definitely an interesting day on Thursday.
How do I put this? It was either surreal or spooky to see the dollar down after a big move by the ECB. And that was in the face of strong jobless claims number at 259,000 down 18,000 claims. And it still did that.
Right. And it was really puzzling me. I was going back looking at Bloomberg, trying to figure out news on the dollar, trying to figure out this did not make sense until I read that comment from Draghi. The other thing I read as I was searching, you know, trying to figure this thing out, Bloomberg had an article which essentially kind of hit it on the nose. They said, just given the dramatic move by the ECB, it was starting to raise questions about how far the Federal Reserve could diverge from its peers. You look at the ECB, aggressive, aggressive, aggressive. And then here we are with the Fed. Nah, we're not really concerned about what's going on globally. We're going to raise interest rates because we want to, and because we need to, because we need to raise them. You know, we need to drop them essentially in the future. We need our policy tool back. You know, given this may be the last accommodative move, like Draghi said, you know, that essentially spun the divergence trade on its head, which has been to, as I said, buy dollars, buy T-bills, short euros. And so the reversal in the dollar Thursday was big, John, but it's currently near some significant support. And, you know, we still have yet to hear from the Fed and to hear the important information from the dot plot next week, as that will be released along with their statement and press conference, et cetera. And then we also get the Bank of Japan. So I don't anticipate any decisive moves yet in currencies, which typically lead markets, but it sure does add some fuel to this rally we've been talking about in commodities over the past few weeks, given that the dollar has weakened again. This is like the third major drop I've seen in the past 2 months. But especially if monetary policy divergence, if that divergence trade is over, at least for the time being until the Fed starts raising interest rates, there is still the interest rate differential. So you look at where government bonds are in Germany, look at where the U.S. Treasury is on 10-year or 30-year, very wide gap. That's still going to attract money here. But essentially, you know, the sentiment, the extrapolation of further drops in interest rates in Europe, that essentially has been, like I said, spun on its head. So, you know, John, the other area that got a lift that was interesting from a result of the central bank conversation over the last couple of days is financials. They were up pretty big on Friday. The idea there, and even in Europe too, is that the reduced capital risks are there and that there might be a better earnings potential given the moves in the ECB this week and a possible increase to loan demand as interest rates have dropped. But that's been hard to really put a finger on, even here, given in the US, all the 3.5 installments of QE. You look at money supply on M1 and M2, really haven't moved up. And so really hard to make that argument, but essentially that's what's moving the financials short term, is this idea that we could get a change at the margin for interest rates.
Okay, Janet Yellen's due on Capitol Hill next week, Ryan. The Fed has three tools we could anticipate that it will be using next week to manage expectations. That's one of its big jobs, believe it or not. There's the statement and then the dot plot estimates for rates and other economic statistics. So as we're looking at all three of these things, which of these do you think is key? What are you going to be watching especially?
I guess breaking down those three tools, the first one to hit the market is the statement. So looking at that, we're going to want to see how the Fed is viewing, you know, the economics globally, the financial conditions overseas. As we've mentioned in January and February, credit default swaps were going up. That's the insurance on bonds. That premium was going up. So it was basically highlighting credit risk. And then many other issues. Manufacturing was even starting to drop here in the US. So the last thing was that they said they're closely watching it. Now we want to see, do they believe it's balanced? And then also anything they're discussing regarding inflation, they actually added some language in there about oil at the last statement. So, you know, this whole idea of inflation dropping and being transitory, essentially, you know, energy dropping being transitory, that's had a very large effect on employment, with high paying jobs in energy now being replaced with low paying jobs in other areas. That was a concern with the employment data that we got just last week. That's that. The second thing we get to hear is from Janet Yellen at the press conference. You know, every quarter we get that. And so we'll want to look at some of the questions that are asked, usually very intelligent by the media. One of them, you know, we're going to want to see is how does she address the unemployment rate, which is very near their target for full employment. Also, the inflationary target, which essentially year over year for factoring out all the issues with energy. If we just look at the core data has actually gone up on the inflationary target. And we're right now, I believe 1.7% year over year as of the January report. And that was relatively near their estimates for the year end of this year. So if inflation starts to tighten up some more, which as I think I mentioned 2 weeks ago, we had seen a lot of figures that were pointing in that direction. Well, we want to hear from Janet. You know, what she feels about that inflationary target. Are we near it? And then what could potentially the Fed do if that target rates goes up or down? Finally, the last one you mentioned, the dot plot, is essentially the estimates that the Fed has towards a number of different economic factors. But the main one we look at right now is where they're projecting interest rates at the end of this year, 2017 and 18, but mainly this year. Because last year in December, the last time we saw the dot plot, they essentially didn't really move the needle very much for December, lower. You know, the market was looking to see it lower and essentially was pricing in 4 hikes. So we're going to really want to see that gap between the Fed futures, which right now gives a probability of around, I think, 40% for a rate hike after June of this year. So June, July, September, the different meetings, we're giving right around 40% probability, not very high. 96% chance next week we see no hike. That's being priced in by the market. We want to see that gap between what the market feels where interest rates are going to be and where the Fed thinks interest rates are going to be. We want to see that narrow. So that will be very important. And then I guess next week, like I said, the Bank of Japan will also be out. There's the idea that they're not really expected to do so much since they just did a very big drop down in negative rates in January, at the end of January. I think it was 28th. So they're probably going to want to see, you know, what happens after that big policy move. They understand there's policy lag of a few months after they make a change. So they're probably going to be on pat, but there are expectations right now that they'll do something before July. But as we say every week, we'll just have to wait and see what the news is and how the market reacts. It should be interesting next week as well.
Good weekend, and we'll see you next week after all of this transpires and then have something to say about it.
Should be interesting.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
PFS Group's Chief Investment Officer, Chris Poplava, joins us today. And Chris, in the past, you've been generally bullish on both the markets and the economy for a long time, making a case that we were going to continue pushing forward both in U.S. economic growth and in the market. And you have been right. I know that there's a number of things that you look at for determining your overall outlook, but lately you have been turning bearish and for good reasons. When we look at the market, we have seen a lot of volatility. Of course, we saw one of the worst starts on record for the stock market heading into 2016. The market has bounced off of its lows, and the S&P appears to be trying to retake 2000. It's backed off from there. So let's start with your overall market outlook and where you think things are headed this year.
Well, I think, you know, taking a big picture view, what's most important to me is getting the economy correct in terms of, is the economy still expanding? If it's expanding, is it accelerating or is it beginning to decelerate? Generally, what I'm looking at is the growth rate of the economy. The reason why I do that is because if you look at asset classes perform differently from each other depending on where you are in the business cycle. If you're in a recession, bonds and cash outperform stocks and corporate bonds. If you are in the middle of an expansion, stocks are one of the best places to be. And so it's very important to figure out where you are in the business cycle, whether you're expanding, peaking, or entering a recession. One of the things I look at is a whole host of indicators. And, you know, what I'm looking for is signs and footprints that the economy has peaked. A case in point would be the last cycle. In the last economic expansion, the bubble was in housing, And so housing activity peaked in 2005. And then because of how that interplays with the financial industry peaked, for the most part, in 2006. In 2007, we saw the consumer peak. And then the manufacturing base for the country really didn't peak until 2008, when we were already in a recession. And that's because exports were still doing well, because European growth, emerging market growth in China were still growing strong, and housing hadn't really impacted the whole global economy. And so economies have different sectors and industries that tend to peak and bottom at different times. And there's certain hallmarks, too, that we tend to see before we even slip into recession. We could have the potential for a recession on the horizon. You know, given the momentum and strength of the economy currently, I think the odds of recession this year are quite low, but I think the odds for 2017 are significant. I think we could very well be in a recession mid-2017 to late 2017, and if that's the case, then I would expect to see the stock market peak in advance of that as the economy begins to slow down, corporate earnings slow down. If you look at corporate earnings currently, I believe they're flat to negative for the S&P 500. So we could already be seeing the early signs of this, that we do have a recession on our horizon.
The news keeps getting better. Stocks are going up, bonds are staying stable, and commodities are starting to rise. Is that mean we're off to the races again? Or could this just be a bear market rally? The fundamentals seem to be diverging from what the charts are saying. Joining us on the program is Louise Yamada from LY Advisors. And Louise, let's begin with the S&P 500 after a double dip in January and February. We're marching our way upward. Is this a beginning of something new, or is this merely a bear market rally?
Until proven otherwise, to us, it's a bear market rally. It looks very similar to what happened back in September, October of last year, with the rally into November. And we had suggested we could see something similar, and now we're seeing a hesitation. Our targets were 2,000, possibly 2,050 on the S&P, 17,000, maybe 17,500 on the Dow. And it's stalling right at the declining 200-day moving average, not just for the Dow and the S&P, but all of the U.S. indices except for the utilities, really. And I think that it's conceivable here, very interesting, that this morning's rally couldn't hold, that we might be turning down once again. Our long-term momentum sell signals are still in place, so until we see something a little bit more definitive in terms of maybe new highs or something of that sort, we are still confined under these declining 200-day moving averages and the declining downtrends that have been put in place since the peaks in May. So I think that we need to see a number of things reverse before we could say that this is anything more than a bear market rally. We had suggested in the end of February that both the rally and the bear probably had unfinished business ahead. And this is the rally phase, so we'll see here whether it can continue to go up or whether today's little reversal is going to start a decline.
Yeah, because when you look at the S&P on a weekly chart, it just looks like the markets are rolling over. And, of course, we follow fundamentals, but everything I'm seeing, earnings peaked in the summer 2014, and I don't see anything coming from companies that have announced their earnings, Louise, that say that, hey, good times are ahead of us. In fact, we're seeing just the opposite.
Yeah, I think that that's your aspect of it, and it's corresponding with what's happening in the price. And actually, the S&P from a weekly basis is also right up against the 200-day declining moving average, but also right up against the resistance that was broken back in September of 2014, to be honest with you, the first time.
Normally what you see in this phase of a cycle is you start seeing money gravitate to, let's say, safer areas of the market, whether it's utilities or consumer staples. You look at a chart of Procter & Gamble or Coca-Cola, they're looking pretty good. Is this more indicative, Louise, of a topping phase or of a market where, you know, money managers start looking for safe areas to park their money?
Yeah, I think that that's very true. And the consumer staples has actually pushed out to a new high, as opposed to, you know, some of the other indexes. The utilities and the consumer staples are very close to continuing their uptrends.
Now, staying on the market, it's also not just here in the United States, although we're probably looking better in some of the overseas markets, but, you know, things don't look that good overseas as well. So it's not like there are a lot of places you can hide in the markets today if you look around the globe.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And having looked at all the European markets, yesterday, they were just up against their declining 200-day moving averages. I think there were only two I could find that weren't. One of them was Taiwan, and the other one was a smaller market. But basically, everything has similar kickback patterns, which suggests that at least a test may lie ahead of us at some point in the near future.
You know, Louise, there are a lot of cliches, there are a lot of norms in the market. For example, you look at the presidential election cycle, the third year was supposed to be a good year. Well, that was last year, and we know what happened to the market. The fourth year usually isn't as good, and it almost seems like we're following this pattern of volatility in all asset classes that we saw last year. Do you see some similarities?
Well, one interesting statistic, apparently, is that when you have a two-term president, the eighth year is not a good year. The eighth year of that presidency is generally a negative year, and that's another statistic that we're dealing with here that doesn't get pointed out too often.
Yeah, so we're seeing this gravitation by money managers into safe areas, as we just spoke about utilities. You're seeing, as you mentioned, consumer staples breaking out to new levels. At some point in a bear market, even the consumer staples start to break down, do they not?
Yes, eventually the best go last, and if they continue to go up, at some point they'll come back. But the outperformance, or the good behavior, I should say, is that maybe they pull back to breakout levels rather than going to new lows. You know, we have done a little study called All Advances Are Not Equal, in the sense that some stocks are in uptrends and can move further along in those uptrends. Other stocks are kickback rallies into already broken resistance. And then the third group is the very, very depressed stocks that may have a dead cat bounce off their lows, where you don't know yet whether energy is actually establishing some kind of stabilization or trying to bottom, but it is only the first move up from some kind of very small accumulation.
Now, I know we have talked in the past about interest rates, and interest rate cycles tend to be longer playing than stock market cycles. It's been an interesting year. The Fed raised interest rates in December. There was expectation they'd be raising rates in March, that rates would be heading higher this year. Instead, they've done just the opposite. What's your take on interest rates and viewed of where the Fed is right now or what they might potentially do?
Well, I think one thing that has to be recognized is that the Fed has cut their issuance of the 5-year note and higher notes and bonds so that there's a much smaller supply of those time extensions. And therefore, people who are looking for, the demand hasn't changed. So if the demand hasn't changed and the supply diminishes, it's going to push the price up and the yields down. But if you look at the 2-year note, it actually doesn't show the same profile. It's still in an uptrend. It temporarily violated or penetrated the 1981 downtrend, and it's right back up there again now. So I would say that the short end is telling us more or less what the rise in interest rates that the Fed has given us are doing, rather than the long end, which has been significantly cut in its supply.
Well, we know one thing now, with negative interest rates in Europe, and now we have negative interest rates in Japan, with Europe lowering and making negative rates more prominent now, that makes the U.S. more attractive. I never thought yields in the U.S. at 2% or less would look attractive, but I guess when you're comparing that to negative yields overseas, we look very attractive. How could that not help the dollar get stronger, Louise?
That's a very good question, and I think the dollar hasn't made up its mind yet. It's been over a year in a trading range between 93 and 100, and it's gone up and down in that range several times, and according to, you know, what the other currencies in the world are doing. And I don't think it's clear yet whether that's going to sustain or whether we break out to new highs or not. I suspect it would take another interest rate rise to get the dollar to move higher. But the one thing that is going up on this negative interest rate fear, I think, is what's propelling gold at this point.
Yeah, because if you look at the price of gold, if you look at even the gold stocks, I mean, you take a look at the GDX, it's up over 40% this year. If you look at the silver stocks, they're up over 50% this year. So the stocks seem to be confirming the move in bullion. Looking at a chart from a weekly basis, going back 4 or 5 years, it looks like gold is attempting to break out of a long-term downtrend. What's your take on gold here? Is this something of significance, or is this, once again, a bear market rally as we're seeing in stocks?
I don't think that we can answer that question just yet, but I do think that the lift through 1200 was a breakout. We alerted our clients. It broke out through the 2013 downtrend, and it lifted above one or two of the prior lower highs, if you understand what I mean. It's like a descending triangle, and clearly it breached those levels on the upside or penetrated those levels, suggesting that something in the supply-demand chain had shifted. We also got a long-term momentum buy signal on gold, which doesn't necessarily mean it's the beginning of a continuing or initiating a new bull market, but it does suggest that there is further to go for gold. And I think that you could see a rally over time, perhaps toward 1400, which is where the 2011 downtrend comes in and intersects.
So when you look at gold right now, and when it moves very quickly. It's very explosive. If you look at it, it almost looks parabolic at this point. Would you be waiting for a pullback at this point if you were to make, let's say, an entry trade? Or do you think that now is a good spot to get in? Because it does look parabolic from where it was at the beginning of the year.
Well, on a very short-term basis, perhaps, but it's a nice breakout. You like to see a breakout that carries a certain distance. At the moment, it's struggling below the broken 2005 uptrend, which was initially broken in 2014. And you might see a little bit of a pause here that tries to come back toward 1200 and consolidate a little. But otherwise, the weekly momentum is rising, and you could just progressively move higher here on a gradual basis. I wouldn't be looking for anything extraordinary, but I think that it is a hedge against this negative interest rate that we're seeing across the globe, and gold looks stronger in some of the other currencies that have been so depressed and are, in fact, carrying negative interest rates.
You just wonder if gold is sniffing out the lack of efficacy of these central bank policies. I know there was a story in the Wall Street Journal recently in Japan after they implemented negative interest rates. Japanese consumers, there was a run on safes and you couldn't get a safe. And they're basically saying, I'm not going to keep my money in the bank if you're going to charge me interest. I'll just buy a safe, keep it in there. And who knows, mattresses may be next.
Yeah, exactly. I know a lot of the banks here don't allow you to put in gold or cash. Isn't that extraordinary?
That is amazing. And then I think a lot of people forget that even some of the bigger banks like JP Morgan, if you are an institution, let's say you're a corporation like Apple with lots of cash, at the institutional level, a lot of the big banks are charging their customers interest to keep their money on deposit.
Yeah, that's your negative interest rate implication. And we also saw just last week that some of the Japanese fund managers are closing their money market funds because they don't want to deal with the negative interest rate implication.
Here's a question for you, because you've been in this business a long time. The United States is unique in the sense that, you know, we sort of initiated money market funds, and we have more money market funds than any other country in the world. What would be the implications, Louise? Like, let's say we went into a recession next year, or let's say the next recession, whenever that's going to be, and the Fed was to resort to negative interest rates. Wouldn't that have adverse consequences for money market funds?
I think it definitely would. I'm personally very disappointed that whether it's the ECB or our government that isn't insisting, well, let's take the ECB because there's so many different countries involved there, that they're not insisting on some fiscal policy, because monetary policy is not supposed to be controlling or having the responsibility totally for getting the economy going. We've had a non-functional government. And we need to see some fiscal responsibility in cutting back costs. And until that happens, I think the monetary segment is strapped. And I agree with you. I don't think it's going to work until we see some fiscal responsibility.
I agree with you there. And speaking of fiscal responsibility, I don't want to get political, but this is one of the strangest campaigns I've ever seen, at least in my career.
Where, that's for sure. Yeah,
I mean, you don't know what is going on, and that cannot be good for the markets, Louise, because you and I know the stock market likes certainty. And whether it's going to be one candidate wants higher taxes, another one may even start a trade war. But I'm surprised the markets have not reacted more, let's say, on the downside, given so much uncertainty that's being imposed by this election process.
You're not the only one that's wondering about that. There hasn't really been a change during this whole process and arguing debates and whatnot. The market has just been moving along in a normal fashion, rallying, if this is a bear market rally, and maybe turning over again. But it had started that process well before we started these antagonistic debates.
If this is a bear market, some say when the market's down 20% or more, that's defined as a bear market. When you take a look at the two bear markets we experienced previously, the bursting of the tech bubble in 2000, and then, of course, the financial crisis that began in 2007. They were very severe, with the S&P down in over the 40% range. When you look at this market right now, from the charts, fundamentals, your own experience and years in the business, does this look like a papa bear, mama bear, or a baby bear to you?
That's a question that's difficult to answer. At this point, I think that the only way that we would be able to define that is if we see the recent lows of January and February broken, and then assuming the presumption would be that we're going to new lows. But we have to recognize that it's really only the S&P and the utilities and the Dow and the NASDAQ that are not down 20% or more. You've got the small caps, the Russell, the New York Stock Exchange, they're all down. So they have already achieved bear market levels. And if you look at some of the individual energy stocks, which are down from 20 to 80%, I mean, they have really suffered badly. And a lot of the financial stocks, too. So it's not as though we don't have a bear market going on. It's just that it hasn't yet been reflected in the Dow and the S&P. And that's a little bit similar to 1995, 94, 95, where the Dow and the S&P went down 9%, but the small and mid-cap names all went down much, 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 much more and suffered bear market levels. Now, I'm not saying this is like 1994, 95, but it's certainly something we could tuck in the back of our minds.
So as you look at all asset classes, right now we've got commodities rallying. Mainly we're seeing that in precious metals and oil. Interest rates have moderated since the beginning of the year, and the stock market seems to be in no man's land. It rallies, then it gives it all back. It rallies and gives it all back. As you mentioned, the major averages have yet to have a major breakdown, such as the Dow and the S&P. How would you be positioning yourself here as an investor?
Well, I think having some of the consumer staples is fine. I'm not sure I'd run in and buy them at this level, but if you have them, I'd hold them. The same thing for the utilities. But the utilities, it's very diverse. Some of them look incredibly poor, and some of them look better. So you have to really pick and choose carefully among the utilities what you might be invested in. And I have no problem owning a little bit of the two-year notes. I mean, it's a safety factor, but they're yielding 0.92, which is certainly better than a negative yield, or a five-year if you're, you know, young enough to take that chance, because you get 1 point something, which is certainly better than elsewhere. I have no problem putting some safety money in there and not putting it at risk.
And would you be dipping into, let's say, precious metals, given where they are right now?
Yeah, you could start a small position, I think, as long as we've got that monthly buy signal for now. And I think that it may be a slow progression, but it doesn't hurt to have some as a hedge against the market itself, because gold and the S&P 500 actually move inversely on a relative basis. In other words, if the equity market is rising, gold generally underperforms, and if the equity market is underperforming, gold generally outperforms. So at the moment, you have a situation where gold is having at least a contra trend bounce as the market has been topping out.
Louise, I know you do a lot of work at the institutional level, but you also have a newsletter that you publish monthly that covers all the major sectors and different asset classes. Why don't you tell our listeners more about this monthly newsletter that you made available to individual investors?
Well, you're very kind, Jim. Thank you. We do. We publish monthly, usually the last week of the month. And we do a market coverage, and we cover all the major sectors. And it's in the sector area where we discovered the potential breakdown in energy in 2014 and the potential breakdown in financials in 2007. So, you know, it would protect clients from the losses that took place in those two areas. And that's the major draw, but we also cover gold and currencies, et cetera. And you can just send us an email from the website for subscription information if anyone's interested.
And Louise, that website once again?
You can just Google my name, or it's LY Advisors will bring you right to it.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
Approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Professor Wade Pfau. He is a professor of retirement income at American College. And Professor, you recently wrote a paper called 8 Core Ideas to Guide Retirement Income Planning. And the first step in that process or a theme is play the long game. In other words, retirement plan should be based on planning to live, because we know that a couple age 65 could spend between 25 years of their lifetime in retirement rather than planning to die. Explain what you mean by that, and what does this entail when you talk about playing the long game?
Right. So, I mean, I think people really understand this idea, but they get caught up in the heat of the moment and sometimes forget about it. So one example of this would be claiming Social Security benefits. And it's very common, about half of the population claims as early they can at age 62, because they're really thinking in their mind, they're worried that they're not going to live very long, and they feel like they would lose out on their Social Security if they delayed claiming. You can delay until age 70, and if they did that and then died at 68 or 69, they really would have missed out on their Social Security benefits. But that kind of thinking is really planning to die rather than planning to live. And you're not really going to be all that much worse off if you delay Social Security. And I mean, you are worse off because you die early, but in terms of your financial picture, that will be a less expensive retirement. It should financially have worked out okay. The issue is really, if you do end up living into your 80s or 90s, then you really have a lot of efficiencies if you start early by thinking about long-term strategies, strategies that may only pay off if you do live a long time. Putting that kind of groundwork into place that can really help you to enjoy a better retirement throughout.
Well, while stock markets are in a rally mode, many indexes still remain in negative territory. At least they're going up. But there's one asset class that has outperformed all other asset classes this year. Believe it or not, it's precious metals. Just think about these numbers. Gold prices are up close to 20%. Silver is up 13%. And if you look at the gold indexes, the gold stock indexes, the GDX is up almost 49%. The GDXJ, which is junior stocks, is up 46%. And look at silver. Silver juniors up over 60% and silver stocks up over 40%. Is this the beginning of a new bull market or simply a bear market rally? Joining me on the program is Dave Morgan from the Morgan Investor. Dave, we have seen over the last 4 years, we've seen rallies in gold periodically, only to fizzle out as the price headed down over a four-year period. Now, if you look at a chart and take a look at where we've gone since, let's say, the beginning of February, It looks like a NASA space launch. So as you look at this market, in your opinion, is this the leg of a new bull market, the beginning, or simply a bear market rally?
Well, Jim, I believe it's the start of a new bull market, but I'm cautiously optimistic because we haven't really seen a confirmation from the silver market. Yes, silver is up, but if we go and drill down a little bit on the metals themselves, gold, as of last Friday, not this Friday that we're doing the interview, gold was up about 19%. Palladium was actually off 1%. Platinum was up about 10%, and silver is up about 12%. And the HUI is up 55%, and the XAU is up 47%. So the stocks usually lead in a new bull market, so that's a positive, and that would indicate strongly that we're in the new bull market. The volume is critical for any market, and the most amount of money has come into the gold ETF sector as a whole since 2009, which, as most of our listeners know, was off the 2008 financial crisis, where even gold sold off. And gold and silver were really the first off the bottom in the 2008 crisis. So more money has come in since that time frame. So huge volume into gold. And if you go to The Economist that published recently, they stated that it was the best start of the year for gold in 35 years. So everything's about gold, 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 and it's all good, and the volumes are high. So I would definitely state, in my view, strong one, that we are in a new bull market. Where the caution lies is that all of the whites, palladium, platinum, and silver, have not confirmed the gold rally. I am a believer, it's not a fact, that like in the Dow theory, the transportations really have to confirm the industrials. I like to see silver confirm gold, which means, in the way I look at the charts, we'd want to see at least $16 silver. We haven't seen it yet. It implies one of two things, that either silver is going to play catch up very quickly and confirm this move, or it won't. If it doesn't, then what I see is that we're going to pull back, and we will regardless at some point. Well, you know, my favorite expression from the commodity side, back and fill, rebuild the base, test certain levels, and see what happens, and then we'll probably move up from there. So I think we've got another month or so to go up, and I think that after that, you'll probably see some type of consolidation. In fact, I'm sure you will. I don't know if my time frame call is going to be correct or not. What I do know is there's a huge short position in the gold market still, and the shorts are getting nervous, which means that somebody's probably going to bail in, meaning they're going to take their loss and gold will go higher, and silver will probably come up with it to some level. But once that is completed, then you're probably going to see it fall off, and you'll probably see these traders. The other caution, Jim, is the commitment of traders reports. They are not favorable to gold and silver. The thing that people don't seem to grasp about the COT is that some people used to, and I used to pretty much be in the camp, that the commitment of traders was like the, excuse the expression, gold standard to be able to trade. And at one point in time, it really was. But those days are long, long gone. Once the gold ETF was initiated, and subsequently the silver ETF, and all these other now what I call holding companies and other ETFs, not only in the primary markets, gold and silver, but in the subsets, meaning, you know, double long gold, triple short gold, all these ETFs that are out there, really muddy the waters. And because of that fact, the COT is useful, but it is not nearly as good at timings as it used to be.
You know, you bring up a real interesting point there, Dave, because what has happened in the past, and you and I used to talk about this in the last decade, you would watch what the commercials were doing or what the smart money, and whenever they went long, you knew that silver or gold was going to go up. Whenever they went short, you knew there was a downturn. But that was because leverage was in the market. You had this money. But now, as you brought up, there is a new avenue for gold investments. You take a look at the bull market in the 70s. You know, not too many people were familiar with futures market. You know, maybe they might have gone into their coin dealer. But today, with a click of a mouse, you can, you know, buy GLD or SLV, and it's very easy to participate in the metals market. So wouldn't you say, in addition to the COT, you really have to follow fund inflows into ETFs? It was interesting because BlackRock, which has a gold ETF, had problems where they had to suspend some sales because they had not filed for enough share issuance to accommodate the massive inflows that were flowing into the sector. So would you say that ETF fund flows are more important today than the COT?
Yeah, I'll give you a short answer, which is unlikely, Jim. I'd say it's critical. That would be my word. I really think that you really have to be, like anything in life, you know, you have to continue to study. And as you know me personally, I mean, I'm a lifelong learner. I've never stated I know everything about the silver market. I'd like to know, but I certainly strive for that. But yes, it's critical that you follow those fund flows.
So I want to throw something out because it strikes me. In fact, we're doing a show on gold today, and that is I've been looking for a catalyst. And a lot of people thought when the Fed launched QE1, which was back in March of 2009, we saw that big, huge swing in gold prices as the dollar was debased. And then when the Fed launched QE2 in the fall of 2010, we saw silver go from 19 all the way to 50. Gold went from 1400 all the way to 1900. And Dave, there was a thought when they launched QE3, which was almost QE infinity, $80 billion a month, that gold would take off. It didn't. Instead, it was the beginning of a bear market in gold. And since then, a lot of money went into financial assets. To me, what is driving this latest move in gold, and we can talk about supply and demand here in just a minute, is negative interest rates. And it's no coincidence that when Japan announced negative interest rates in February, you can look at a chart, and gold took off and launched. And Japan's negative interest rate was followed by Janet Yellen on Capitol Hill, where the subject of negative interest rates was brought up, and the Fed actually said they've been looking at it and studying it. So to me, negative interest rates is the strong catalyst here for the gold market, because I think it reflects a growing lack of confidence in government and also the efficacy of monetary policy. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, you threw a lot at me, and thank you. First, I want to just reiterate a little bit about the QE2, QE3 situation. When QE2 was announced, you accurately stated silver went from 19 to 48. And I made that trade. And I'm grateful. And many of my followers at the Morgan Report that get to look over my shoulder watched me do it. I got in 19. I actually got out of 26. Once QE2 was announced, it was at 26. And I got back in and rode all the way to 48 and got out into strength. Probably it was a few days before the actual top, which being a trader that I am, I've learned selling the strength and leave some for the next guy. Having said all that, I want to get on the fundamental fact. And the fundamental fact when QE2 was announced that almost everybody, and yours truly included, thought that we would see inflation start to come into Main Street. It did not happen. It was liquefying the banks further. It was keeping them solvent. It did everything for the paper markets, and nothing manifest in the real world on Main Street. And because of that fact, that the savvy people, I'll say, this is my opinion, took the announcement of QE3 as a non-sequitur. It's not going to cause any inflation in the real world. It's not going to be manifest in Main Street. One of my guys that works with me said, oh my goodness, QE3, you know, and I help him with his trading and So the point is, he says, I'm getting long. I said, do not get long. You want to hedge. This is not going to work. He goes, well, how do you know that? I said, well, one's experience, and two is QE2 didn't work. There was an anticipation in the marketplace. Look at what took place in the silver market. It's not going to happen. And as we both know, I was correct and others were. I'm not trying to pat myself on the back. I'm trying to explain that this anticipation of inflation hitting the Main Street did not take place. Moving on to negative interest rates, I want to speak about that. I met Dr. Barry. Dr. Michael Barry and myself are pretty close and have been for years. And some people may or may not know that, you know, in my business, you know, contacts mean a great deal, as in yours, Jim. And Dr. Barry speaks to the Fed directly and has for years. And, you know, I keep in touch with him, not on a daily basis, but on probably every other month. Who's at the PDAC, happened to run into him and asked him, when is the next time you speak to the Fed? And he says, very soon. And I said, well, you know, my normal questions are, do they know what they're doing? And the answer is not really. And what are you going to speak about? He said, I'm going to speak about negative interest rates. And I said, well, what are you going to say? And he didn't really go outline very much, Jim, but it basically coincides with what you just outlined. This idea that the printing money is going to help the situation. I mean, I'm going to digress a little bit here, Jim. I know we used to do interviews fairly often, and that's fun. I'm happy to be on your show whenever. But, you know, we talked about a decade ago of the metaphor of, you know, the dam breaking in, you know, putting a finger in the dam, in the hole, and then another one, and another one, another one. And my metaphor was that at some point, printing money just won't work. That no matter how much they print, it will not solve the problem. Well, we've been in that situation for quite some time now. So since that doesn't work, these people think that the zero interest rate policy, which didn't work, all you have to do is tweak a little more and go to negative interest rates and it's going to work. It does not work. It will not work. And as Dr. Berry said, and you stated, it is going to be beneficial to other markets, and gold and silver are probably the two primary markets that it's going to benefit.
You know, it was interesting because after, I think it was about a week or two after Japan announced negative interest rates, I was reading an article in the Wall Street Journal, Dave, that pretty much summed up the thoughts here that you and I have. They were talking to Japanese savers, and they were basically, there was a run on safes in Japan. Because people are saying, you know, I'm not going to keep my money at the bank and pay them to have my money on deposit. So Japanese savers were buying safes, and you couldn't get enough safes. But then they were interviewing one saver, and he says, look, he said, I'm going to get a safe and anything I have left over, I'm buying gold. So it just goes to show you a lot of times central banks may try policies, but I think what we're seeing here is a growing realization by the market of the efficacy of monetary policy is running out. And Dave, I personally, my own feeling during the next downturn, given where interest rates are now, the Fed doesn't have the same leeway that it did when it started to raise interest rates back in 2004 when the Fed funds rate was at 5%. I mean, we've had trouble. You know, it took the Fed a year to raise interest rates a quarter of a point. So I think in the next round or downturn, whenever that comes, I think we're more likely to see what Ben Bernanke talked about. In the war against deflation, a central bank can always win. And he talked about a helicopter drop. And it reminds me back in 2009 when the Obama administration announced a $1 trillion fiscal stimulus. And at the same time, the Fed announced a $1.2 trillion money printing stimulus. And I would not be surprised if that's what we see again in the next downturn, given where interest rates are, rather than negative rates, which would have a greater impact here in the U.S. because of our large presence of money market funds. So all of that, in my opinion, negative interest rates, helicopter drops, 0% interest rates, creates a favorable background for precious metals.
I agree, but I had a little bit different take. First of all, I want to agree, and then I'll offer this thought. I'm not sure. In fact, I did a whole, most of the Morgan Report in January happened to do with what's going on with Barrick Resources, and the editorial had to do with what we're talking about, this interest rate quandary. The idea of raising interest rates is to make your currency stronger, basically. And the Fed, as you said, took a year to do it and did it in such a modest way. It's almost something that is a non-event. Although the markets reacted to that, or you could say that the markets reacted to that rather significantly. My take is that it could happen again, or they could stay put and not go lower for a while. And here's the reason why. The Chinese have offed about $1 trillion in the U.S. debt markets. And yet interest rates didn't change at all. Interest rates, as we know, Jim, and our listeners know, is the cost of money. And the cost of money is very low. But when you get rid of something you don't want, you change that. It changes the market. But there wasn't a change. So, one, how did that happen? And two, my idea is since the Fed is comprised of people that are fairly savvy, really. They understand that if someone is exiting a dollar in that significant manner, that the only way to keep the suckers in the game could be to leave interest rates higher than all their currencies worldwide and then force these other players, we'll call them, into the dollar, even though they may not want to be there based on the fundamentals. They could be there because interest rates are positive in the USA land and not anywhere else on the planet in significant currencies like the yen or the euro. So it's a little different way of thinking about it. I'm not trying to state, you know, I'm correct, but it is a different way to think about it. And this is my current thinking, Jim, in that editorial that I did in January. I said, I don't know where it's going to end. I have a pretty good idea of how it's going to end, but I do think interest rates are key. And of course, the debt markets, as I wrote in the Silver Manifesto, the debt bomb, that chapter, it's all about the debt markets. Yes, the precious metals are my specialty, and yes, it's important, very important. But nonetheless, it's the debt markets is where we are most concerned.
Well, I mean, if you take a look at the policy of financial repression, Dave, it's amazing. We did a show on financial repression not too long ago. In 2008, the government had $10 trillion in debt and paid $451 billion in interest. Fast forward to 2015 fiscal year, which ended last September, the government had $8.5 trillion more in debt and yet paid $50 billion less in interest expense. So if you look at where the next president will be facing, or what the next president will be facing in January 2017, President Obama will leave office with $20 trillion in debt, doubling the national debt, just like his predecessor, George W. Bush, who doubled the national debt from $5 to $10 trillion. Obama doubled the debt from $10 to $20 trillion. And central banks and governments cannot handle, let's say, higher interest expense, because right now the government's paying 2.3% on all of its debt. Every 1% increase in interest rates is another $200 billion in interest expense. So if we were to normalize, as we were in the past, at 5% Fed funds rate, Dave, that's $1 trillion in interest. There's no way the government can afford to pay that.
Exactly what I said in my editorial. But still looking at the coin from the side and seeing the edge, I mean, I really want to see both sides at the same time, which is the rock and the hard place, the devil and deep blue sea. Which way are they going to go? Are they going to let it go? Or the market's going to take over. There is no government authority figure. You can talk the BIS, you can talk the ECB, I don't care, the G20, the G8, I don't care. They are not going to solve the problem. The market is going to solve the problem. So do you default because people don't trust the currency? Or you default the other direction where you just admit that it's never going to be paid. I don't know, but the market's going to take care of it. And I think it's more sooner than later. I know I wear the doom and gloom hat. I'm a realist. Look, it's always happened in the past. And even when it happens, doesn't mean that the world stops turning. What it does mean is that all this misallocation gets reevaluated. Things that need to be swept to the side and go out are gone. The problem is, you know, so immense, and there are so many counterparty risks in the derivatives world that the unwinding by the market is going to be so significant that it's going to go into the historical record books in the financial markets. I'm convinced of that.
Well, Dave, as we close right now, we've seen a big run up in gold. Gold up 20% compared to 13. You talked about earlier, just like we like to see the transports confirm the industrials. You believe we need to see a confirmation by the white metals, platinum and silver, palladium, to confirm the move in gold. Would you be a buyer here, or would you wait for a pullback here, number one? And number two, would you be more towards investing in the bullion versus the equities?
Well, since I'm one of the few that does both the commodity and the equity side, most do like the commodity side or the equity side. On the short term, I was in $1,200 gold. I'm still holding that with a pretty tight stop. So on the short term, yes, I will just let the market take me out when it decides to. On the longer term, you know, if you're a buy and hold mentality and you buy now and it pulls back, I think it'll be fine, because I am convinced that we are in a new bull market. So, you know, timing is everything. But if you don't trade, and most people shouldn't trade, I think buying here, you're fine. Will it pull back? Probably. Will you get better buys? That's hard to say. Perhaps you could. But I also want to hit strongly that, you know, I've never advocated put everything in the metals. I mean, this is something that you know, people hear the sound money story and it becomes an ideology. It is maybe for me personally, but for the general public and this very savvy investor, the very sophisticated investor, really a 10% weighting is plenty for most people. I think I'm right as far as, you know, the unraveling of the markets in the future, but this could muddle on for quite some time. And there's innovative ideas. There's always good things happening out there in the world. There's just too much in the financial sector. I mean, if you've got 40% in the financial sector and you're pushing paper back and forth and not really producing stuff for the physical economy, that needs to be rectified, and it will be at some point. In the meantime, you know, do your best, enjoy life, be a savvy investor, be an astute investor, weight your portfolio correctly, and, you know, live your life to the best of your ability. I really have an obligation in a way, Jim, to let people know that, because once in a while, not often, someone gets the idea that this is the only sector to be, and it's not true. I do want to recommend everyone go to our new website, themorganreport.com, and I just finished, and I mean literally just finished, it was yesterday, a new report called Riches and Resources. It's for free. All I want is your name and an email address that you can verify. It's an 11-page report. It's a top-down analysis looking at the big, big picture film that actually I was in with many others about the Age of Empire and where we are from the big perspective. And then we drill down from the Age of Empire and how it unwinds down into the markets themselves.
All right, Dave. Well, I was glad to hear you say that because even though you and I are bullish on the metals right now, I'm glad that you said there's a limitation, because there are people out there, and we're not going to pick on them, but they advocate, you know, put it all in, go all in. You know, you should be fully invested in the precious metals market. And over the years, including yourself, I've interviewed Dr. Faber, Felix Zuloff from the Barron's Roundtable. I've never heard any of them. In fact, I think Dr. Faber said, if you were really, really aggressive, no more than 20%. So I'm glad to hear you say that, because sometimes when you see the metals move like this, people think that's it. They're looking for that one pill, that one sector, that one investment. Well, Dave, as we close, once again, give out your website. So if investors want to read that new report you just put out, how could they do so?
Yeah, just go to themorganreport.com. It's all one word, themorganreport.com.
Bull market in the first part of the new century, then gold, the metals went into a malaise, and everybody's saying, what's going on? We don't quite understand that. But all of a sudden, gold seems to be blasting off again. $20 trillion in debt almost, financial repression underway. The central banks don't seem to know what to do. So what is the effect it's having upon gold, and are we seeing a new bull market? That's the first part of the big picture. Storm warnings on the horizon. What are the leading economic indicators, both domestically and globally, telling us? And what does that mean for investors? Because there is a storm and she's a-coming. All of that coming up next on the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.